Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 2nd, 2004. Today's session number is OLJ 2004-01. Today's speaker is Jeannie Olson. The lesson for today is, Are You a Listener, Healer? Let's listen in.
Because obviously, when this class is over, we're very close to lunch, and I don't want to run over the time. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Jeannie Olson. At home, I am a hospital chaplain in Davenport, Iowa, in a hospital called Genesis Medical Center. I have been doing that for 19 years. I feel like I have the most wonderful job in the world, and I absolutely love it. As I said on my thing, I tell people when I'm going to Holden that God has a summer home, and it's at Holden Village. So my next favorite thing is being here at Holden amongst all of you folks that make us a village, and it's a privilege to be here. When I was thinking about this theme for this summer, and Paul and I were asked to be the village philosophers, which is an interesting job description. I'm not sure we figured that out, even though we've been doing it for a week, but it's been fun. But when they talked about the theme, and I read Janet's wonderful article about summoning out what we shall be and finding out what our calling is, and I read her article, she talked about ways that is done. And one of the things that wasn't mentioned is in the being called out, how do we do that? And I think one of the ways that we do that, from my perspective as a hospital chaplain, is that we have to tell our story to somebody. We have to talk to somebody in a sacred, safe place. And in the telling of our story, we figure out with our own inner wisdom where we're going and what we should be doing with, for example, our lives or the transition we're in or the tragedy that we're in the midst of. And so not only do we need somebody need to be the teller of the story, but someone then also has to be the receiver of the story. And I do believe that we as people of faith, it is our calling to be that listener and to be that listener in a very special way. Now, I'm sure people think, well, listening, you know, I can do that. Well, how well do we listen? And if you're like me, we so often jump in and want to fix things. Because we think we have such good advice for folks. So what I'm going to be doing today is talking about listening from a new perspective and how we can be healers, hopefully, in that listening process. Because I truly believe that when people are listened to, a healing takes place, physically, spiritually, mentally, and so on this journey. Now, because I'm a hospital chaplain, I'm going to be probably talking from that perspective, but and using some of those as examples, but they can be used in any realm. When I was, early on when I was a chaplain, and I would go up to the floors and they'd say to the nurses or somebody, you know, what referrals would you like to give me today? And they'd say, oh, there's a nice little lady down the hall. She's pretty sweet. Why don't you go talk to her? And I'd say, well, that isn't exactly what I'm looking for. Who do you have on the floor who's angry, who's frustrated, who's lonely, who's from out of town, who has to make difficult medical decisions, who's been given a new diagnosis, who's your non-compliant patient, or who's ready to throw a bedpan at you? And they go, oh, that's the sort of person you're looking for. I said, yes, those are the sorts of people who need to tell their story, who need to be listened to and viewed as a whole person and not just the cancer patient in room 36 and so on. So in our ministry at the hospital, yes, we do sacramental ministry, we do prayers, we do baptisms, we do services and so on. But if I was to describe what I do as a hospital chaplain and the rest of our staff, there are five of us, I would say in one sentence, we are a listening, caring presence. And we don't bring our own agenda into a room, but we allow patients to tell us what they need by telling their story. So that's one reason I think the story is so important, because I see it happening every day that I'm at work as patients tell their stories. I believe the story is also the best way to get a point across. So I'm going to tell you a story about Ed. Ed's wife had cancer, and she had a very bad kind of cancer. And the doctor came up to me and said, I don't know what to do with this patient. She has a very bad kind of cancer, and when I go in to talk to her, Her husband sits in a chair on the other side of the room, and he laughs while I'm describing the things that we need to deal with. And I went, he laughed? She said, yes, and I don't know what to do with them, so you take care of them. That's kind of how we get referrals. You know, whoever they don't want, nobody else wants to take care of them, the chaplain gets called. So I went to meet Ed, and when I was introduced to him and shook his hand, I said, hi, I'm Jeannie Olson, the chaplain. He went, ha-ha. I went, this is a person who's, when he's nervous, has this little ha-ha. It just comes out. And it's not that anything's funny, it's just a nervous reaction. So I listened as the doctor was talking to the patient and the husband, and this nervous little laugh would come out. And I knew that the next day that she was going to be having surgery, and I knew the time. And so while she was up in surgery, I went to the lounge where I found Ed sitting by himself. And when he saw me again, he was really nervous, and he was just kind of looking at the floor. And I asked him a couple questions, and I could tell this was difficult for him. And I said, Ed, tell me about your wife. What's she like? And he kind of said, well, and he could answer that question. And all of a sudden, he started telling about his wife. Well, I met her when she was 16, and married her when she was 17, and I was 23, and she was just a child, and she didn't know how to do anything. And so, but we got married, and so I was teaching her how to take care of the house. And then he started talking about the children, and he's rattling on, terribly animated about this whole thing. And all of a sudden, he stops, and he has this look of horror on his face, and he goes, "I can't believe this. I'm talking to you. I don't talk to anyone. I don't talk to anyone. Why am I talking to you?" And I said, "Well, you're doing a very good job." And he went on with the story. He just went on with the story and continued on about their relationship. 15 minutes later, he stopped and he goes, "I'm talking to you. I'm telling you my story. Why am I doing that?" I said, "Well, you're doing a very nice job." And on he went. After an hour plus, this is what happened. He slowed his conversation down. I want to read it because it's a quote. He said, "I have been taking care of her since she was 16. Now I feel helpless. There's nothing I can do. I don't know how to fix this." And he started to cry. But it was in the telling of the story that he could finally figure out what this situation was, that he couldn't fix it anymore. And in the telling of the story, he figured that out. Several more times I saw him. Whenever he was in the company of his wife or his kids, he didn't talk to me. But if I got him in the lounge, again, he'd go on with the story of how he was dealing with this. I happened to do this lady's funeral. And after the funeral at the cemetery, the son came up to me and said, "I don't know much about you." He said, "But I do know this, is that my father never, ever, ever talks to anyone about any feelings or any stories in his life. And I know he talked to you, and I just want you to know that he said he couldn't have gotten through this without someone to talk to." Now, I'm not telling you this because I'm telling a story about me, because any of the other chaplains in our department could have done that, as could our befrienders, who are our lay volunteers, who are trained to go into rooms and say, "How are you doing?" to patients, and patients tell their story. So it isn't a story about me. It's a story about telling the story and how important that is in someone's need to heal. And what I call that is kind of safe, sacred space. Hopefully, we create that when we're with someone, that they feel safe, they don't feel judged, and they are allowed to tell the story without us breaking in to give advice, give ideas, etc., that we so often do. So what is our sacred story? Now, some of you have probably seen this kind of example done before, but each human being is a sacred story. And to be a human being, there are certain parts of us that are the facts of who we are. And in the story are part of the facts. So the fact is that I have a job and I'm a chaplain. The fact is that we perhaps have a spouse or a significant other. The fact is we may or may not have some children or some children who are important to us. And we may live in a particular house. We may have a particular church we go to, causes that we're part of, a salary we make, you know, whatever is significant in the facts of who we are. So, is this a full human being? No, that's just the facts of who we are. So added to the facts of who we are, maybe I better take this one out. Anyway, the other portions of who we are our experiences, our causes, our values. I tried to get sand out of the pile out of here. I took some from the children. I hope they didn't mind. Our joys, our feelings, our frustrations, our relationship with others. And now we're, if I shake this down, we're a pretty full human being, aren't we? But we're still not a complete story or a complete human being. There's one very important thing missing. That's our faith. That's our relationship to God, however we view God, he, she, Christian, Jewish, whatever. The faith portion of who we are permeates everything and holds everything together. So in the telling of our story, if we're only giving facts, we're not getting much of the story. When we get into the feelings and the emotions and the journey, we're getting into more. And when we get to that faith aspect, the core of our being, and how we relate to that God, that is our more complete story and our more complete vision of who we are. We are our stories. And again, I'm going to say that the telling of the story, when we tell that story, I believe that our own inner wisdom comes out. So instead of somebody breaking in to tell us what to do, as we tell that story, we figure out what to do because of that spirit that lives within us, that Holy Spirit, that faith, and because of the wisdom that God gives us as we understand our own stories. I have a chaplain that I work with who says that story is to spiritual life what breath is to physical life. Obviously, we can't live without breathing. And it's our contention in our department, the way we do things, is that story is as important to our spiritual life as breath is. And in the story, listening is a form of healing, even though it doesn't change. It had illness, but I'm changing here to situation. So when I have a best friend who's going through a divorce where her husband became addicted to gambling, alcohol became involved, another woman became involved, her coming to me and us talking over a cup of coffee, the situation never changed. Those three things stayed in the picture. The divorce stayed in the picture. But as she shared the story, she moved through it with her own understanding of who am I now that? And you fill in the story, your own blank, of what that would be for you or with someone who tells that story. Who am I now that I have cancer? Who am I now that I've got a terminal or chronic illness and I have to move out of my home into a nursing home? Who am I now that I've gone through the grief of my significant other? Who am I now that I don't have a job? Well, as the telling of the story, the situation doesn't change, but we figure out how to live with that. I'm just going to also give you an example of what we do in the hospital. Many of you probably work in a hospital or in a volunteer situation where you meet strangers. Whether you make visits in the nursing home, you meet people in your church as their new members, here at Holden. So I'm going to give you the example of how I do this in the hospital, just to be an example of how to get that whole story. I may walk into a patient's room, and I know that her name is Mrs. Smith, let's say. I walk in, and I see that the room is full of flowers, and I may say, "Nice flowers, Mrs. Smith. It looks like a lot of people love you." What have I already done? I've already called her by name and noted that she has a whole lot of people that care about her by the evidence of the flowers. I'm Jeannie Olson. I'm a chaplain. May I sit? I'm needing to ask permission because this is her space. She doesn't have much control over anything in this hospital. But who comes into her room that, you know, isn't somebody to take blood or be the doctor? She needs to have some control over. May I sit? She gives me permission to sit. I may say, you know, this is a person on the cancer floor, let's say, and I say, how are you doing? Now, a person may say nothing, or a person may begin to open up. One of the most important things is for someone to tell their story honestly. They have to be alone, because for the most part, people protect the people they love. They won't tell you the full story if their significant other or spouse is sitting there. Why? Because they protect them. And they won't tell you the story if their kids are sitting there, because there's this protection. Each person is protecting the other. So I try and do this when no one else is in the room. So I say, how are you doing? Well, this person says, I'm 61 years old, and I felt so physically fit, and now I have cancer. And the story goes on, and I get the diagnosis story, how the story happened. And then she goes on to tell me the treatment story. And now this is what they're doing to take care of me. I said, oh, you must feel like this is a nightmare and you're going to wake up. Oh, she says, I do. And I get so angry. So all of a sudden, we're into the feeling part of this and how she feels, the anger that she has toward having this. I said, I think I might feel angry too. So in doing that, I'm affirming my own feelings if I was in that situation. So obviously, that's not judging hers for feeling angry, but affirming that. Of course, that would be a very understandable feeling. Then I said to her, I bet it's scary, isn't it? And she went on to say, it's really scary, and went on to do some more feelings work. Then I said, have you ever had anything like this happen to you before? Now, what we're doing here is getting into the history. How have you seen other people deal with this? She, oh, yes, my dad had cancer. And she went on to talk about her dad's illness. And how did he cope, I asked. She went on to tell how he coped. So then it was an important question, go, and how would you want to cope with this? And then she went on to say, well, I learned this from my father, and I'm, you know, et cetera. And she talked about what coping mechanism she would use. And I said, to get it even to a deeper level, I said, what gives you hope? What gives you meaning in your life? That's getting to the water part, the spirituality. What holds you together? What gets you up in the morning to give you the strength to go on? Now, some people say, well, you know, I just take one day at a time. And that's their theology. That's their philosophy. But some people say, if I didn't have my faith, I don't know if I could get up each day and face these cancer treatments and so on. So we talk about faith and how that helps, and how that helps her get up each day. Or sometimes people just mention God, and I'll say, you mentioned God. Is that part of your life? Is that part of your support? And on the story goes. So the listening is active. I do very little except ask a question, nod, keep the conversation going. It's her story, and she needs to tell it. Maya Angelou said, there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story within you. Now, maybe she meant that as a writer, because writers have to get those stories out or those poems out. But I believe that's true of all human beings. That story is in. After being a chaplain for 19 years, I am still absolutely amazed that I can walk into the room of a stranger and they will tell me their life story to the depths of their being. That's still amazing to me. And that's why I believe that what I do is such holy ground, because people share to the intimacies of who they are. Now, what happens when you tell a story is, and you know, you don't like, sometimes these things are good, sometimes these things are bad. But when you're telling a story, you do have, can you see this from back there? Facts?
No.
No. Okay, then I'll tell you what this says. It says facts, feelings.
Bring it back up a little bit, Jean. It gets bigger if you back her up.
True.
You make it a little larger. There you go. A little larger.
Okay, well, I'm not going to turn out the lights because I really don't want you falling asleep on my class. So I'm not going to turn out the lights. Facts. People will give you the facts of their story. We went through that. Then they'll oftentimes go to the feelings, go on to back to the history, when have they dealt with it, which is what I said before. And then this important place of understanding, healing, transformation. Now, not always is this going to happen in every conversation, but oftentimes it is. And maybe it's just going to be, that's so good to get that off my chest. I'm so glad to be able to share it. And maybe it's going to be this aha moment, which many of our befrienders come down and share. Somebody said, you know, I don't want to go to that nursing home. I don't want to go there. I've always said I'm going to be in my own home. And I'll say, you know, how are you going to take care of yourself? Well, I don't know. I can't get to the bathroom. I can't cook. I can't. I'm condensing a story. But by the end of the story, the person looks at me and says, you know, I really can't take care of myself. What I probably need to do is go someplace where I can be in community, where they can cook for me, where they can do my laundry. This is sounding better all the time. But my kids have been telling me, I need to do this, I need to do this, I need to do this. And I don't like to be told by my kids what I'm supposed to do. But as she told her own story, she came to the conclusion herself, and how much better that is than, and I know, don't we do this all the time, especially with the people we love most? It's hardest to do this and be this, non-judgmental, non-jumping in listener if it's not our family members. Those are the ones we're worst at, right? Because we think, but what happens when we give advice, when we jump in? It looks like we're trying to say, you don't have a clue how to do this, and I'm smarter than you. Even though we don't say that, that's what we're implying, is that they're not smart enough to figure out what to do. I have to tell you a funny story. Sometimes the stories are quite funny about stories. Ed was one of our befrienders, and this is a different Ed, by the way. He came down, and we always have our befrienders, who, for those of you who are a little late, are trained lay volunteers, who are trained for 28 weeks, an hour and a half every week, on how to be this listening, caring presence. And Ed said, I've had a visit today I've never had before. And I said, well, tell me about it, Ed. He goes, well, I went into this room and I introduced myself to this gentleman. He had a very thick accent. And I don't remember his name, but I'll call him Mr. Smith again. And I said, hello, Mr. Smith. I'm Ed Horn, and I'm your befriender today. And oh, and he, with a thick accent, he indicated I should take a seat. And I said to him, how are you? And all of a sudden, he started talking. And his accent was so thick, and he was talking so fast that I couldn't understand what he was saying. And I'd catch a word here, John Deere, so I figured he worked at John Deere. He was perhaps in his 70s. And I'd catch wife, and I'd catch kids, but he was talking so fast, I have no idea what he said, but he talked for 25 minutes straight, and all of a sudden he stopped and he said, thank you so much for being my friend. Very slowly, so that Ed said, I knew I was being dismissed, because he was shaking my hand and thanking me. And I said, oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure. He said, I came straight down because I just didn't know what to do at that visit. And I said, Ed, does it make one bit of difference that you don't know the facts of his story? He said, no. No, I guess not. I said, did he love to be able to tell it? Yes. Did he thank you for being present to that story? Yes. He shook my hand and smiled. I said, is it important then you didn't know? He said, no. I said, by the way, Ed, how did you keep the story going? He said, well, I did what we were taught in Befriender class. I just kept my eyes on him, and when he looked sad, I looked sad. When he looked happy, I looked happy. And when I didn't know what to do, I just nodded. I love that. I love that. Because, you know, the facts aren't all that important in the story. We're a listening, caring presence. That's what our ministry is all about. Sometimes, as I told before, sometimes people need to talk it out to figure out where they're going. We had a patient who had to figure out whether they were going to be a DNR status, do not resuscitate. And as the person told the story, I said, well, have you ever been in an experience like this before? This person had a terminal illness. They were going downhill. They knew they were going downhill. They were still doing treatment, but they knew that if their heart stopped, which is what DNR status is, you just don't come in and start the heart again, it might be easier way to die than to go through this long terminal illness that they were having. And I said, have you had any experience with this? Well, yes, my dad had such and such, and then he had a stroke, and he was in treatment, and we took him to the ICU, and he couldn't speak, but we could feed him, and he couldn't talk, and he couldn't, I said, and he looked at me, and I said, well, how was that for you? And he goes, it was awful. We had to send him to a nursing home, and all he could do was, you know, eat with somebody fed him and couldn't talk to us. And as he told the story, he went, this is a no-brainer, isn't it? He said, I don't want that to happen to me. I'd rather if my heart stopped that I go that way than to go through the process of the illness. So people come to these wonderful conclusions by themselves without us giving them advice. The one thing that we so often do on this chart is we jump We leapfrog, as we call it in our training, to being that one who wants to solve it for them. I'm going to leave some things out because I want to have a chance for you to be able to talk about being a listener or a receiver of stories also. But I do want to share something from Kitchen Table Wisdom, which is a wonderful book. This is the only copy left. Rachel Naomi Riemann is, and I don't know if I pronounced her name right, is an MD, and this is a collection of not even short stories, but things that have happened in her life as a doctor. She also has a chronic illness that she deals with. She also has written a book called My Grandfather's Blessings. And she, as I said, an MD, but that also has a chronic illness, which I think makes her a better MD. But she says in her book, and she talks about an experience she went to. She says, everyone alive has suffered, but wounded people can best listen and heal other wounded people. Only other wounded people can understand what is needed for the healing of the suffering. It is compassion, not expertise. Now, this is not to diminish our psychiatrists, our psychologists, those people who for whom there is a place. But how important not is our expertise, but our compassion, which means we're all called to this job of listening. She tells about the situation. She's this doctor at Stanford, pretty impressive, right? She's on the faculty there. And Dr. Carl Rogers, who some of you know is the humanistic psychotherapist, comes to do a workshop for all these doctors. And she's pretty glib about this because she says, you know, what can he teach us? And he's going to teach something called unconditional positive regard. And I'm going to read most of this because I want to give you her words. She said, unconditional positive regard came down to sitting in silence and accepting everything the patient said without judgment or interruption. And she goes on to explain the situation. Finally, Dr. Rogers offered us a demonstration of his approach. One of the doctors in the class volunteered to act as the client, and they arranged their chairs sitting opposite one another. As Rogers turned to him and was about to demonstrate the session, he stopped and looked thoughtfully at his little audience of expert doctors. Then he said, before each session, I take a moment to remember my humanity. There is no experience that this man has that I cannot share with him, no fear that I cannot understand, no suffering that I cannot care about because I, too, am human. No matter how deep his wound, he does not need to be ashamed in front of me because I, too, am vulnerable. And because of this, Dr. Rogers says, I am enough. Whatever his story, he no longer needs to be alone with it. This is what will allow his healing to begin. The session that followed was profound. Rogers conducted it without saying a single word and conveying to his client simply the quality of his attention, which was total acceptance of him and his story. The doctor began to talk, the doctor who's the client, began to talk, and the session rapidly became a great deal more than a demonstration of a technique. In the safe climate of Roger's total acceptance, he began to shed the client his masks, hesitantly at first, and then more and more easily. As each mask fell, Rogers welcomed the one behind it unconditionally, until finally we glimpsed the beauty of the client doctor's naked face and story. I doubt that even he had seen himself that way before, and by that time many of our own faces were naked and some of us had tears in our eyes. And she goes on to say, as she reflects on this, whatever the expertise we have acquired, no matter what our occupation is, the greatest gift we bring to anyone who is suffering is our wholeness. Listening is the oldest and perhaps the most powerful tool of healing. It is often through the quality of our listening and not the wisdom of our words that we are able to affect the most profound changes around us. When we are listened to and have our story told, when we are listened to and we offer our story, we share our wholeness. Our listening create sanctuary. Don't you love that word, sanctuary? Or the homeless parts of the other person, which may have been denied, unloved, or devalued. Her last sentence, listening creates, and I love this, a holy silence. When you listen generously, and again, the generously is the key word here, to people, they can hear the truth in themselves, and often for the first time. Ooh, I love that. I love that. But I think cartoons are the best teachers, so we're going to go to that next. I absolutely love this cartoon, and I hope some of you get for better or for worse in your cartoon. Oh, that's going to be difficult. Okay, we'll do the first one first. Am I going the right direction? Okay, the story of this is, some of you have this in your paper, for better or for worse? Okay. As you may know, the grandfather has, his wife has died. And he has gone to his daughter's house to figure out what he's going to do and to spend some time after grieving. And this is a wonderful experience in what one does to share this concept that I've just shared with you. He's saying he's laying in bed, he's gone to bed, every day I try to look happy, I try to be funny, I try to cope, but I miss you so much, Marion. So he's talking to his wife. And what, again, what has I said before? Nobody's honest with their loved ones. They act like they're okay, so they try and cope. I feel like a kid again, lost in a big, strange bed, afraid to be alone. Think of all the words he's used. Alone, afraid, miss you. And all of a sudden, the little dog comes into the bedroom and kind of pops his head in. And then we go on to the next one, which came the next day. I'm not good at doing things backwards. Well, hello, Edgar. What are you doing here? So now he's talking out loud, even to a dog, right? Don't we all do that with our dogs? You know, they listen to us. You want up? You're not supposed to be on the bed, but the dog licks him, and so he lets the dog up. Okay, fine, if you insist. I was just about to spend another miserable night feeling sorry for myself. He's telling his story. And the dog now cuddles in and lays his head on his chest. And he says, how did you know? How did you know I needed this physical presence and I needed you to touch me and be here? The story goes on. I love this dog. So, Edgar, and he goes on talking. So, Edgar, what's next? What am I going to do with my life? Now, he has reached out and touched the dog. You know how comforting, any of you have pets, cats, dog, we have to touch that, you know, stroke it. It gives us a sense of not aloneness. So he's stroking the dog. And the dog, if you can see this, is looking straight at him. Good eye contact, just like our friend Ed, who kept looking. So, good eye contact. Do I go home and live in the little house in British Columbia? Or do I move in here with my daughter? Now, the dog knows this is a key question. So what does he do? He lifts his head up to give him more attention because he knows this is the pivotal question, one of the pivotal questions that has to be dealt with. This dog is such a good befriender of Jacqueline. And he's still stroking the dog. And then he says, but I guess I don't have to make that decision now, do I? I have enough to deal with as it is. He's come to that place of understanding. Okay, you know, there's enough to deal with. I don't have to take care of this. I can be okay with this. Again, the dog knows, yeah, we've come to the end of the story. And he's got his hand on him. There's nothing like talking things over with a friend. The dog is there, and he has this wonderful look of peace on his face as he closes his eyes. I'm not trying to compare chaplains with dogs, but I would say that this dog would be a great chaplain or befriender, which is probably the reason we have pet therapy in our hospital. That would be as opposed to bad listening. I've stopped listening and you're still talking stare. you know, on her eyes, she's glazed over, she's got closed body posture, and he's rambling on, but we don't have a listener here in this situation at all. Body language, sometimes can even be more obvious. Hi, how are you? Well, my foot is well, look what time it's getting to be. Nobody really wants to know how you are. Now, I don't know if you have this in your place of work, but when you're moving from one place to another quickly, he says, hi, how are you? And you just keep walking. Uh-huh. Because it's the American way. You had, why did I do that? I didn't take the time to find out how that person really was. But it's so ingrained to say, hi, how are you, and keep going. How bad is that? You know, yeah, she doesn't want to know how his foot is. And she keeps going. While I'm on a roll here, I might as well do all of these since I'm up. Peanuts, woo. Of course, another good one. Oh, this way. How was school today? I failed story listening. Well, of course he failed. And he fell asleep, you know, in story listening. And falling asleep is really a bad thing to do when you're listening to somebody. It shows you really don't care about their story. So whether you need a cup of coffee beforehand or whatever.
You ever had that happen?
Oh yeah.
You're so tired in the middle of a session with someone, you nod off?
I haven't yet, but I've bitten my lip, and I've dug my fingernails into my hand, and I've done a lot of things.
And I won't get autobiographical.
I've done a lot of things that I... But Stephen Covey, which many of you know in the... Oh, dear, how do I do this? Real listening shows respect. I mean, real listening. Walking by someone and saying, hi, how are you, does not show respect for wanting to know, but real listening does.
Well, I think if it's seen as a convention, maybe, Jeannie, that and people realize you don't really want to stay and listen to what their answer is, then it is just like saying hi.
Yeah, yeah. But it's probably better we just say hi.
Maybe just say hi, yeah.
Hope you're having a good day or something,
yeah, something like that,
that
right.
Ends it, yeah.
Right.
One of the... I'll go back a place. When we're having a conversation with someone, and I don't know where I got the statistics, you hate to use one when you don't really have a place where you can say, this is where I got this. But in a conversation, when someone is perceiving you, this statistic said that 55% of what someone gets out of a conversation with you is their body language. Wow. You know, are you there? Are you present? And Ed was a good example of that. His body language says, I'm right with you. I'm listening to you. 55%. 38% is the tone of your voice. Is your voice compassionate? Or is it frustrated? Or is it impatient? Is it judgmental? The tone of your voice. Which leaves, folks, only 7% of what's said in a conversation are the words that are exchanged. Think of that when we're having a conversation with someone. There's one of the, and probably you would know this, but in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who grieve, for they shall have someone who's called alongside, says my Episcopalian friend who's the priest who reads Greek. So blessed are those who grieve, for they should have a called person walking alongside of them. Well, when you do that, that just shows you're right with them, that you're not trying to pull them in your direction, and you're not trying to push them into something they're not ready for, but to be called and walking alongside of them. What a wonderful image that is. The next thing I want to talk about very quickly is life review stories. One of the most important things, especially in working with older people, or in being with older people, or in being with someone who has a terminal illness, is hearing their life story. I was working with a man by the name of Mr. Anderson, and I walked into his room, and I was told he was kind of a grumpy person who didn't talk much. And his covers were way up to his neck, and he had the TV on, and it was the History Channel, and it was watching about the Depression, but he was just kind of not watching it, he was kind of staring. And I said, hello, Mr. Anderson. I introduced myself, and I said, watching the History Channel, looks like the days of the Depression. He was 90 plus, and I said, do you live through that? No, of course I did. He said, yeah. I said, that must have been a very difficult time. Was that difficult for you? He said, yeah. I said, how so? And all of a sudden, he started talking about the Depression. And I said, when you came out then, what did you do? And he told me about going to college. And I said, well, tell me about your career. And all of a sudden he started sitting up more. And he said, well, then finally became a bank president. What bank? Oh, Davenport Bank. Well, biggest bank in town. And he, as he told the story about then he got married and his children, and he sat up and the covers came down and he pulled himself up and his voice became stronger. And he was telling the story and became very animated about who he had been when. In the middle of this conversation, a nurse's aide came in, and remember, this is, and he also talked about all the things he had done in the community. And a nurse's aide came in, and she walked completely, didn't, kind of oblivious to the conversation, walked in, patted him on the shoulder, and said, how are we doing today, Tom? I see you didn't eat your breakfast. And I thought, she doesn't know the story. This is someone that when he was president of the biggest bank of the Quad Cities, he was called Mr. Anderson. And he told people what to do. And no one would have condescendingly, patronizingly patted him on the shoulder and called him Tom. And no one would have said, why didn't you eat your breakfast? Because she didn't know the story. When she left, I thought, oh goodness, is this all ruined now? And I said, well, tell me about your kids' accomplishments. Well, one of the things that we're proud of, usually as parents, is when people ask us about our kids and we can tell them, we are indirectly kind of saying, I did okay. I raised a family and they're making a living and they have children and my grandchildren are good people. And as we finished this, and about 45 minutes later, I said to him, He looked at me first, and he said, I had a good life, didn't I? And I said, you certainly did, and you made a lot of difference in our community. He said, thank you for saying that. He said, and thank you for listening to an old man reminisce. My guess is when our befrienders or other chaplains do this, that is a form of healing, because people are able to look at themselves and go, yeah, yeah. And as people get closer to those end years and to dying, and have been these people, and they are this story, they want to be able to share that. And why they want to be able to share that is they want to know that their life had purpose, that their life had meaning, that they had a positive effect, and they contributed to society in a wonderful way. Roy Schaefer was one of our dear befrienders, and I just love him. And in his 80s, in one of our gatherings, he said to me, old people's stories are the most beautiful artwork in the world. Don't you love that? Mm-hmm. Old people's stories are the most beautiful artwork in the world. And if they don't get to tell those stories, we're not going to be able to see the artwork, are we? Because those stories have to be brought out for it to be enjoyed. One of the last things I want to talk about, I think one of the last things before I open this up, is how important metaphors are when we listen to a person's story. Now you're going, metaphors. Let's see, I had this in high school English, college English. What are those metaphors? And just to remind you, they are liking one thing to another to make it more poetic, more concrete. For example, if someone says, I feel like a sinking ship, we got an idea of a sinking ship and what that means. Maybe it's the Titanic, maybe it's a little dinghy, but it's a sinking ship and they're on it. Or cancer is my enemy, and now I need to go to battle, and I've got to get the artillery, which is my chemotherapy. So they use these metaphors to tell their stories. And poetry, the intensity of the metaphors increase as the intensity of the story increases. So if somebody says to you, I'm down in the dumps, well, okay. But if somebody says to you, I'm a train wreck waiting to happen, whoa, that's more dramatic, and the poetry is more powerful. Metaphors make a story more concrete. We can see it if someone says, I'm a train wreck waiting to happen. Or if someone in grief says, I've lost my right arm. My spouse was my right arm. I can't function. We can see that what that means. Metaphors make a language richer. Somebody says, I'm feeling terrible. Well, okay, that's pretty vague. But if someone says, my life is a battleground and I'm losing, we get a whole different picture of what they're saying. And metaphors are engaging. When someone says, I'm on a roller coaster, you know, this whole divorce that I'm in, you know, I think I'm doing fine, and then this thing happens, and then, you know, and then I'm doing, and then So we see that. We see that. It's an engaging. Sometimes metaphors are challenging. I worked with an oncologist 15 years ago who said, and this was when cancer was an even worse sort of situation, he said, cancer treatments are cut, burn, and poison. Whoa! Cut, surgery. Burn, radiation. Poison, chemotherapy. And in those days, 15 years ago, those things were more cut, burn, and poison than, thank God, they are today. But very challenging metaphors. Sometimes metaphors are challenging. This is a quote of one of the patients that I was working with. She was telling me her story, and then she said, it's like we kids were all his dolls. She's talking about her dad. And he knocked the heads off of all of us older kids. And then he only had one left, so he kept messing with his head to make sure it was still screwed on. Shocking metaphors for what these group of kids went through with their dad. A metaphor is personal. You don't choose your metaphors. You go, what am I going to use? It just comes out of your personhood. It just comes out of your story. It comes out of your subconscious. One patient I worked with who was just a young kid said, you know, when you say, how do I deal with this? I say, I hang in there. Now, he had said this so many times when people said, how are you handling this, that someone had gotten him a monkey that hung on, a toy monkey that hung on to a trapeze over his bed. And he said, that reminds me that I'm hanging in there and I'm going to get through this by hanging on. But when we're listening to somebody and they use these metaphors, what a wonderful thing to use them back. If someone says, I'm a train wreck or I'm in a battle, and you use that metaphor back again, they know you've heard the story because you said, how's the battle today? Or how's that roller coaster you're on? It shows you've been listening to their story. And you can use it back and have them continue telling that story by using them. I don't know about you, but whenever I hear a person's story, I never feel the same about them again. I feel closer. I feel intimate. I feel connected. I feel personally, there's a connection between me and that other person. I know them, and I know what's going on inside, and I know why they look sad, or why they look angry, or whatever. And being a listener, we have to learn to be comfortable with the uncomfortable. It's not always comfortable to be listening to somebody's story. Not comfortable because of the situation that they may be describing. Maybe not comfortable because we'd like to jump in and fix it, because that would be the thing we'd like to do. So whether they're telling family stories, illness stories, grief stories, we can't fix it. But nobody is saved by silence. The last thing I want to share before I open it up to you is a little article that came out of Spirituality and Healing, and in it talks about, the subtitle is The Healing Power of Telling Our Stories. And she talks about the Holocaust survivors. They came out of Germany, and because they didn't want to remember their past, they didn't tell their children their stories. But the children knew something was wrong, and because children kind of take this personally, they think, there's something wrong with me. There's a family secret, and I don't know what it is, but it must be something about me. And so many of these survivors had children who either had depression or were suicidal. And they found out that this was the reason why, that the survivors needed to tell a story. My best friend in high school, her parents were survivors of the Holocaust. It wasn't until their 50th wedding anniversary that they told the rabbi the story, and the rabbi was allowed to tell the congregation the story. And it's interesting how my friend and her sister have dealt with their lives. One of them had tried to commit suicide and had a lot of depression in her life. At least this was this person's contention. Or let's think about the truth and reconciliation situation in the apartheid in South Africa. A man had been shot in the face by a policeman, and when finally the Truth and Reconciliation Council came and the folks were able to come, the African folks were able to come and tell their stories, they finally felt they could start to heal. One of the gentlemen said, who'd been shot in the face by the policeman, I feel what has been making me sick all this time is that I couldn't tell my story, and now it feels like I've got my sight back by coming here and telling you my story. And the last one is about a South African woman who was in an international group, and people were telling their stories, and she told the story of seeing her grandparents slaughtered in her village. in South Africa. And the Westerners who were in this group wanted to comfort her and fix it and kind of move in on her in trying to be comforting. And she actually literally put her hands out and she said, I don't need you to fix me. I only need you to be witness to my story so I can tell you and heal. I love what I do. I have the wonderful arena of being able to hear people's stories when they're in this time of difficulty, when they're vulnerable, when they're sick, when they might be dying. But all of us as people of faith, and who are human beings in general, are in situations where somebody needs us, and somebody needs us to be that healing, caring presence. So I'd like to open it up to you and questions, responses, times you've been heard, times you've been able to listen to somebody, and open it up for dialogue. Yeah?
Jeannie, the one thing you didn't talk about is guilt. And if a person tells you their guilt story,
That's interesting. I listen to fifth steps. We have an alcohol addictions unit in our hospital, and the 12-step program, one of them is telling their story and the things they wish they hadn't done in life, and they share their guilt. That's a good point, because when people need to tell their story of guilt without us saying a thing and without us being judgmental. But I may ask a person, what would be helpful to you after you told the story to continue? Are you a person of faith? And if they are, I will say, have you been to communion? If they're Catholic, have you been to your priest? Have you done the things that will help you continue down the road of taking care of this beside telling the story, of receiving that blessing, of receiving that forgiveness from the priest, from communion, and so on? Thank you for asking that. Would you like to add something to that?
It's interesting that at that point you refer
to God or to
that
others.
That you did. I mean, you're referring him to or her to someone else.
Oh, for sure.
It just interests me.
I never want to, and I probably have that written down somewhere. There are oftentimes places where I need to refer someone if the situation is bigger than me, for example. There are situations that they need to get to a psychologist, psychiatrist. But what we've discovered is that most people just need another human being. But then there are places you definitely need to refer.
Do you ever speak words of forgiveness and absolution to them?
At the end of a fifth step, when I'm dissing, I will ask the person if they would like a prayer. And then I take everything they've said, I'm not an ordained chaplain, I'm a lay chaplain, but I do believe in anointing, and I will ask them if they would, one, like a prayer, and number two, if they would like to be anointed, and I ask them if they are baptized, if they would like to be reminded of their baptism, that they are a child of God. So I don't think I have words of absolution, but as a person of faith, I also believe that
we're ministers.
Thank you. We're ministers. We are all people of God. We're asked to be God's representatives and so on. But I don't feel that I have the ability that, say, you would have as a minister to be able to do that.
I think that Bonhoeffer's book, Life Together, suggests that
priesthood of all believers, that's what I was trying to come
that,
up
with. In fact, it's not good if the pastor is the only one who hears confession.
Oh, right.
For a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons. And some people will not tell their confession or their story
for whatever reason. And conversely, that as long as one person in the faith community himself lives in confession, as you said, it's whole, that person's word of forgiveness is God's word of forgiveness.
Which is the reason I will pray with some and I will anoint someone.
So
but I don't do words of absolution sort of thing.
You have that authority because it's intrinsic in the body of Christ.
In the priesthood of all believers sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
The only thing that there might be is the legal status, depending on what they're confessing. The pastor has the protection legally of confidentiality, which you as a lay person wouldn't have.
I think as a hospital chaplain, I mean, confidentiality is what I'm about. I mean, the stories that I hear stay in my presence and in my room and in my a safe space.
I have Stephen's ministry training, and confidentiality is...
the absolute, yeah.
The absolute.
You had a question here in the front.
I
have to say something.
I just make a comment, which I really appreciate your presentation. I practiced physical therapy for 25 years, and I thought I was pretty good at it, a good listener, but I had the opportunity to go to my brother's nursing school graduation, and there was a woman who couldn't have been more than about 24 years old that spoke, and the thing that so impressed me is she, this was a time when nursing was really, they were laying nurses off, managed care had come on, and all these students were very scared about their future. And she stood up, she said, I'm not worried at all about our future, it's because, you know, we have this two wonderful things, which is we have a chance to be in the presence of people who are at a period of challenge in their lives, and we get to hear their stories. And I'm not ever worried that we're ever going to be out of work, number one. And I just, you know, I really took that as part of my creed. And I keep thinking to myself, you know, when I go to work and I'm feeling like suddenly it's not a privilege, you know, to be with people when they're in trouble or to hear their stories, it's time to go on vacation and do something else for them. Because
good point.
You really should be, you know, when you're there.
Well, what's the funny joke that is it? Physical therapists, massage therapists, bartenders, and people who do our hair. You know, where do we tell our stories? You know, those people are listeners. So, yeah.
I just, it came to mind, I play a lot of music, and I do a lot of performing and storytelling, that kind of thing. And something that I notice over and over and over, and I very much value the asking questions and the listening that you're talking about, but something that I notice so much is that when I authentically share my story in a way that's, you know, in mind of a universal, like this is a we story, not my, you know, that I share my story, and maybe in a concert, you know, I'll mention my mom passing away and play a song, and a lot of the themes in my music end up being you know, death and dying, just kind of, but in ways that are, and I find people just open up so much, so. Just the reverse of what you're saying, that
that's
when
true.
I share my story authentically with the idea that people in the room also have those stories. And recently, just even a week ago, I played this concert and, you know, I just mentioned my mother passed away and I have a son and birth of my new child and this kind of cycle of life or whatever it is. And he came up to me and was saying, thank you so much for your stories. And I, you know, and then he said kind of, squeaked it out and said, my mother passed away a year and a half ago. And I go, oh, thank you, wow. And I asked some questions then, you know, then it was an opening for him. And he said, I've never said that out loud in a year and a half. This is the first time, you know, I'm
wow.
You know, so in my mind, just these, I guess my point is really just that idea of the reverse of what you're saying is sharing. What I find is me sharing my story breaks open and
absolutely.
Makes it a norm for other people to also do that too. So,
and that is an opening. I guess my thing is people who are in crisis
yes.
or needing a listener, but
yeah.
you that's such a
but
wonderful
more like
point.
Just out in the world, maybe
yes.
if you're not
yes.
in a hospital
yes.
setting. Or
right.
Something
or,
like that, it's,
Jean, it says in your biography that you did something special with cancer patients, like music or something.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that?
I started two programs in the hospital. One's called Music for Care and Healing, and it's for cancer patients to be able to listen to music while they're going through chemo, before surgery, after surgery, to help control pain. Because if you're listening to music, your whole body relaxes, especially if it's relaxing music. So if you're tense, you know, you're going to feel more pain. But if you're relaxed, because you're listening to relaxing, easy listening music, every organ and muscle in your body will relax. Well, if you're not fighting against that, you're going to feel less pain. You're going to be able to heal faster. You're going to be able to eat better. You're going to be able to sleep better if you're relaxed. I mean, if any of us want to clean our houses during the day, we don't put mood music on. We put fast, peppy music. We can move fast. So music, depending on what it is, affects
yeah,
our body.
Yeah, that didn't happen or that, but how do you actually do it? I mean,
I have a whole library of music and the patient gets
the
patients, I'm not a music therapist. Music therapists do that. We just have a catalog.
What is specifically that you pointed out the importance of music? Or?
Yes, and also just let them choose whatever they like. if they love classical music, or if they love Christian music, or if they love, you know, whatever, their choice of music is what is important to them.
Are you bringing it to the treatment center? I mean, are they
it's in their rooms. It's on our cancer floor. We have cassette players and CD players, and then they can choose what they like from the catalog. And if they are in pain, or if someone is dying, we'll put on music that would be, you know, kind of easy listening Christian music, instrumental music. What's the most asked for piece of music we have on the oncology floor? Amazing Grace in an instrumental. Because what is it going to do? It's going to lift our souls, you know, to help us move toward those heavenly arms as we move from this world to the next. The other program I have is called Last Letters to Loved Ones. There are people who are dying who want to write letters to that will be opened by their family members after they die. And there's just this small window in here between the time they really believe they're going to die, because many times they don't want to write letters because they don't want to give up hope that they're going to win this battle and they're not going to die. And when they're too, for example, many times you have to take morphine because of the pains. So there's this window in here when most of the time they will dictate letters to me, and I will type them up and we'll make sure that they're absolutely perfect the way they want things said. They thank people. They bring up characteristics of their children that they want their children to grow into, and so on. And I most of the time give them to the family members at the visitation of their funeral.
But you ask them, you give them opportunity if they want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Not everyone does that. Not everyone wants to. Some people have already done it. Some people wouldn't think of doing it. But it's just another program that we offer. I do not believe in keeping classes late, so I will stay here if anyone wants to talk. Otherwise, thank you very much for coming.